Good. Thank you very much. Now I know what a minister must feel. It's pretty empowering up here. what I'm going to do is have you imagine that I'm my brother, Omar Barghouti, who is in Ramallah, Palestine now, and who was invited by Richard to come here to give a Palestinian perspective on the Middle East conflict, I guess. But Omar couldn't be here. You know, leaving Ramallah is a pretty complicated affair, and it takes a long time to prepare. So I'm going to read his statement here. And the title is "The Secular Democratic State in Historic Palestine, an Ethical Compromise." I can already imagine some of you saying to themselves, "Compromise? Is he out of his mind? Well, I'm as sane as a Palestinian can be given the circumstances, but I truly believe that the secular democratic state solution is a historical compromise that has this great advantage over any other two-state solution flavors, which is it's ethical. But before I go into the ethical aspect, allow me to explain why I regard this as a compromise. Being nonconformist, I cannot accept the parameters set forth by the Zionist left in defining the conflict and the various possible solutions. From my perspective, the extreme Palestinian position would be a comprehensive decolonization of Palestine, like what happened in Algeria, while the opposite extreme of the Zionist movement would be a full-fledged settler colonial state, ethnically cleansed of virtually all of its natives, the Palestinians. Thus, a secular democratic state, along the lines of a South African compromise, where Israeli Jews are regarded as equal citizens to Palestinian Arabs, is a compromise that I've consistently advocated. I also believe that a nonviolent struggle is the most moral and pragmatic means to reach that end. Let's dispel one big myth underlying efforts at conflict resolution in this land. The two-state solution for the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is not in a coma. It is actually dead. Blinded by the arrogance of power and the transitory comfort of impunity, Israel, against its strategic Zionist interests, has failed to control its insatiable appetite for colonial expansion and went ahead with devouring the very last bit of land that was supposed to be the nucleus of a Palestinian state. So in fact, there is no land now on which a Palestinian state can be established. Coupled with unprecedented Zionist influence over Washington, this factor has ended any chance for a two-state solution. This phase has all the emblematic properties of what may be considered the final chapter of the Zionist project in Palestine. We are witnessing the rapid demise of Zionism on all fronts, and nothing can be done to save it, for Zionism is intent on killing itself. And I, for one, support euthanasia. Besides having passed its expiry date, the two-state settlement was never moral or ethical. In the best-case scenario, implementing Resolution 242 of the United Nations Security Council resolution, it would have addressed most of the legitimate rights of only a third of the Palestinian people over less than a fifth of their ancestral land. That's what 242 gives the Palestinians. More than two-thirds of the Palestinians, those who are refugees plus the Palestinian citizens in the State of Israel, would have been completely ignored in that settlement. And they have been expunged out of the definition of the Palestinians. Such exclusion can only guarantee the perpetuation of conflict. But who is offering the best-case scenario anyway? No one, as a matter of fact. All that's offered now is significantly less than even the best-case scenario of Resolution 242. That makes it impossible, practically, to establish a two-state solution. Shlomo Ben-Ami, the former Israeli foreign minister, has acknowledged this much. He said, and it's quoted in the Philadelphia Inquirer, "The Palestinians have a choice between justice or peace. Peace decoupled from justice, for us, is not only morally reprehensible, but pragmatically unwise as well. It may survive for a while, but only after it has been stripped of its essence, becoming a mere stabilization of an oppressive order, or what I call the master-slave peace, where the slave has no power and or will to resist and therefore submits to the dictates of the master passively, obediently, without a semblance of human dignity. Well, the Palestinians' prudence is running out. The yielding of their official leadership to force merely led to more colonization and promises of yet more to come. At the very core of the rationalization of the massive ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in 1948 and the brutal destruction of hundreds of Palestinian villages during and after the 1948 Nakba, that's what the Palestinians call 1948, which in Arabic means catastrophe, lies an entrenched colonial belief in the irrelevance or comparative worthlessness of the rights, the needs, and aspirations of the native Palestinians. This is a classic case of what I will call relative humanization. I define relative humanity as the belief and relative humanization as the practice based on that belief that certain human beings, to the extent that they share a common racial, religious, ethnic, cultural, or other similarly substantial identity attribute, lack one or more of the necessary attributes of being fully human, and are therefore human only in the relative sense, not absolutely and not unequivocally. Accordingly, such relative humans are entitled to only a subset of the otherwise inalienable rights that are due to full human beings. This factor has played a fundamental role in inhibiting the evolution of a unitary state solution in Palestine. At the present, and given the impossibility of achieving a negotiated two-state solution that can give Palestinians their minimal inalienable rights, there are three logical paths that can be pursued. One is to maintain the status quo, which keeps the two-state solution alive on paper. Second is for the Zionist movement to finish the job, in quotes, which means implementing full ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians out of the entire Mandate Palestine and creating a pure Jewish state. Three, launching new visionary and practical processes that will lead to the establishment of a secular democratic state between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean. Let us explore each of these three options. First, maintaining the status quo. The status quo today depends on three attributes. One, the denial of the rights of the Palestinian refugees. B, the military occupation and repression of the West Bank and Gaza. Three, a Zionist version of apartheid in Israel proper. I won't go into the details of all of these because I assume you're familiar with them, but the issue of the denial of the rights of Palestinian refugees is a very important one that many people in the West, including the progressive and leftist movement, have ignored for a while. Far from admitting its guilt in creating the world's oldest and largest refugee problem, and despite overwhelming incriminating evidence, Israel has systematically evaded any responsibility. The most peculiar dimension in the popular Israeli discourse about the birth of the state is the almost universal denial of any wrongdoing. Israelis, by and large, regard as their independence the ruthless destruction of Palestinian society and the dispossession of the Palestinian people. Even committed leftists often grieve over the loss of Israel's moral superiority after the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza in 1967, as if prior to that Israel were a civil, legitimate, and law-abiding as Finland. In a classic self-fulfilling prophecy, Israelis have always yearned for being a normal state to the extent that they actually started believing that they were. It is as if most of those Israelis who actively participated or bore witness to the Nakba in 1948 were collectively infected by some chronic selective amnesia. This denial has its roots in the Holocaust and in the unique circumstances created as a result of it, which allowed Israel to argue that, unlike any other nation, it was obliged to deny Palestinian refugees their unequivocal right to return to their homes from which they were expelled in 1948. Preserving the Jewish character of the state, the argument went, was the only way to maintain a safe haven for world Jewry, the super victims, who are unsafe among the Gentiles, and that, of course, was of much more import than the mere rights of the Palestinians. Even if we ignore the compelling comparison between the safety of Jews in Israel versus in France, Morocco, Spain, or the United States, for that matter, We cannot overlook the fact that no other country on earth today can ever get away with a similarly overt racist attitude about its right to ethnic purity. Besides being morally indefensible, Israel's denial of the right of return of Palestinians also betrays a level of moral inconsistency that is in many ways unique. The Israeli law of return for Jews, for instance, is based on the principle that since they were expelled from Palestine over 2,000 years ago, they had a right to return to it. So by denying the rights of the Palestinian refugees, whose 55-year-old exile is a much younger injustice, to say the least, Israel is essentially saying that Palestinians cannot have the same rights because they are just not equally human as the Jews of the world. The second attribute of the status quo is the continuing military occupation and the war crimes. I'm not going to go into the details of a lot of these crimes because you're familiar with them. I will just talk about one new crime that's being committed now, which is the establishment of what the Palestinians call the apartheid wall on Palestinian lands. Although Israel is now trying to present its abominable colonial wall as a security barrier to fend off suicide bombers, the truth is that the current path of the wall is anything but new. Ron Nahaman, the mayor of the West Bank settlement of Ariel, this is one of the largest settlements in the West Bank, has revealed to Yedioth Ahronot, the largest circulation paper in Israel, that the map of the fence is the map I saw during every visit Sharon made here since 1978. He told me he has been thinking about it since 1973. This is a quote from Yedioth Ahronot. There weren't many suicide bombers back then. Despite the wall's grave transgression against Palestinian livelihood, environment and political rights, a near total consensus exists among Israeli Jews in supporting it. Several official and non-governmental bodies in Israel, however, are concerned about the adverse effects the wall might have not on Palestinians, but on animal rights. The Israeli Environment Minister, Yehudit Naot, protested the wall saying, "The separation fence severs the continuity of open areas and is harmful to the landscape, the flora and fauna, the ecological corridors and the drainage of the creeks. The protective system will irreversibly affect the land, resources, and create enclaves of communities, of animals, of course, that are cut off from their surroundings. I certainly don't want to stop or delay the building of the fence because it is essential and will save lives. On the other hand, I am disturbed by the environmental damage involved." Still, the spokesman for the Parks Authority was not satisfied. He complained additionally, "The animals don't know that there is now a border. They are used to certain living space, and what we are concerned about is that their genetic diversity will be affected because different population groups will not be able to mate and reproduce. Isolating the populations on two sides of the fence definitely creates a genetic problem." Now, what's obscene about this argument is not that it's protecting animal rights, it's that the same people cannot even imagine applying the same arguments to Palestinians. It's just amazing. There are many other crimes of the occupation that I will not go into. Just to point out one thing that many people have wondered, do the Israelis know what's happening? For sure they do. It's a small country and there's no escape. They know full well what's happening. The British journalist Jonathan Cook hit it right on the head when he wrote, "Israelis know exactly what happens. Their Zionist training simply blinds them to its significance. As long as the enemy is Arab, as long as the catch-all excuse of security can be invoked, and as long as they believe anti-Semitism lurks everywhere, then the Israeli public can sleep easy as another Palestinian child is shot riding his bike, another family's house is bulldozed, another woman miscarries at a checkpoint. It seems that a people raised to believe that anything can be done in its name as long as it serves the interests of the Jews and their state has no need of ignorance. It can commit atrocities with eyes wide open." But if that's the case, then the two possible explanations, not necessarily mutually exclusive, may be put forth to explain the Israelis' acceptance of and sometimes fervent support for this systematic violation of basic human rights. One, the widespread belief that their demographic war against the Palestinians could be won by implementing the suggestion of Cabinet Minister Benny Elon, who called for intensifying the siege and repression in order to make their lives so bitter that they will transfer themselves willingly. Or two, secular or not, the root of the entrenched Israeli perception of the Palestinians as less human is nourished by a racist colonial tradition and rising Jewish fundamentalism. This problem of Jewish fundamentalism, I'm not going to talk too much about it, but it's an issue that people should take very seriously. We often hear about Islamic fundamentalism, and in left circles in this country, we hear about Christian fundamentalism. Nobody is paying attention to Jewish fundamentalism that is basically has almost transferred the state of Israel into one of the most fundamentalist nations in the Middle East. It's comparable to Iran and Saudi Arabia in many of the most important practices when it comes to marriage, divorce, birth, and so on, the most important functions of life. And I'm just going to quote a couple of things to show this rise of fundamentalism. Referring to Jewish law or the halakha, Rabbi Ginsburg, the leader of a powerful Hasidic sect, defended the 1994 massacre of Muslim worshippers in a mosque in Hebron, if you remember that massacre, by saying, legally, if a Jew does kill a non-Jew, he's not called a murderer. He didn't transgress the sixth commandment. There is something infinitely more holy and unique about Jewish life than non-Jewish life. This is published in the Israeli press. Nobody talks about this fundamentalism. The other aspect of the status quo, the third aspect, is Israel's system of racial discrimination within Israel. This system is nuanced, intelligent, but it's still apartheid. Edward Herman, who I assume you know, writes, if Jews in France were required to carry identification cards designating them as Jews, even though French citizens, they could not acquire land or buy or rent homes in most of the country, were not eligible for service in the armed forces, and French law banned any political party or legislation calling for equal rights for Jews, would France be widely praised in the United States as a symbol of human decency and paragon of democracy? Would there be a huge protest if France, in consequence of such laws and practices, was declared by a UN majority to be a racist state? Well, that's exactly what Israel does to its Arab citizens. And nobody is allowed to call Israel a racist state. In fact, the UN did for a while until the US forced the UN to scrap that. So I'm going to skip over a few things here to reach why I think a secular democratic state is the only possible and ethical solution. Israel's inherent racial exclusivity, as demonstrated above, has convinced many Palestinian citizens of the state that they are not just on the margins, but altogether unwanted. Besides what Palestinians think or want, the question should be posed, can a state that insists on ethnic purity ever qualify as a democracy without depriving this concept of its essence? Even Israel's loyal friends have started losing faith in its ability to reconcile the fundamentally irreconcilable modern liberal democracy and outdated ethnocentricity. Tony Judt, for example, has called Israel an anachronism. Describing Israel as a state resting on, quote, foundations of oppression and injustice, Avram Borg, who used to be the Knesset speaker for the Labour Party, has recently asserted that Israel, in quotes, must shed its illusions and choose between racist oppression and democracy. Daniel Gavron, a leading Zionist, very recently said, and I quote, the main force for anti-Jewish feeling today, I don't want to call it anti-Semitism, is in fact Israel and its actions. The paradox is that Israel is the most dangerous place for Jews today, and also that Israel is endangering Jews in other countries by its actions, by the tremendously militant policies, certainly of the last 3 years, that have caused huge hostility toward Israel and toward Jews. In that sense, Israel, which was a vital haven for the Jews, has now become a liability. I believe that Israel, as an exclusivist and settler colonial state, has no hope of ever being accepted or forgiven by its victims, the Palestinians. And as it should know, those are the only ones whose forgiveness really matters. Despite the pain, the loss and anger which relative humanization undoubtedly engenders in them, Palestinians have an obligation to differentiate between justice and revenge, for one entails an essential moral decolonization, whereas the other descends into a vicious cycle of immorality, violence, and hopelessness. As the late Brazilian educator Paulo Freire writes, dehumanization which marks not only those whose humanity has been stolen, but also, though in a different way, those who have stolen it, is a distortion of the vocation of becoming more fully human. The struggle for humanization is possible only because dehumanization, although a concrete historical fact, is not a given destiny, but the result of an unjust order that engenders violence in the oppressors, which in turn dehumanizes the oppressed. In order for this struggle to have meaning, the oppressed must not, in seeking to regain their humanity, which is a way to create it, become in turn oppressors of the oppressors, but rather restorers of humanity of both. Rejecting relative humanity from any side and insisting on ethical consistency, I believe that the most moral means of achieving a just and enduring peace in the ancient land of Palestine is to establish a secular democratic state between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean, anchored in equal humanity and accordingly equal rights. This new Palestine should, one, first and foremost, allow and facilitate the return of and compensation for all the Palestinian refugees as the only ethical restitution acceptable for the injustice they've endured for decades. Such a process, however, must uphold at all times the moral imperatives of avoiding the infliction of any unnecessary or unjust suffering on the Jewish community in Palestine. Two, must grant full, equal, and unequivocal citizenship rights to all of its citizens, Jews or Arabs. Three, must recognize, legitimize, and even nourish the cultural, religious, and ethnic particularities and traditions of each of the respective communities. Israelis should recognize this moral Palestinian challenge to their colonial existence not as an existential threat to them, but rather as a magnanimous invitation to dismantle the colonial character of the state, to allow the Jews in Palestine finally to enjoy normalcy as equal humans and equal citizens of a secular democratic state, a truly promising land rather than a false promised land. Thank you very much.